a seminar on the 14th of April 1991, the Scandic Hotel, Some Glimpses of the Future by Dr. Douglas Baker.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It is generally agreed that the most difficult part of seership is to be able to date the vision, the experience that you have. We don't have a Big Ben appearing in every vision. And it's extremely difficult. And so I must plead at the beginning of this series of talks for you to be kind and understanding that I can't give you dates every time. I want to start today by giving you an example of how seership can work. Only one example. There could be dozens of others. In 1545, old Henry VIII, and he was an old man then, in 1545, he was still one of the most attractive monarchs in Europe. He had everything, wealth, education, the adoration of his subjects. He spoke Latin, he read Greek, and so on. But there was one factor that had eluded him. It was sea power. It had not yet been obtained. He couldn't challenge Spain or Portugal or the French, and they were developing huge colonial empires. And so he began rather late to build up the English fleet. He tried without much success in this direction, but on the occasion that I'm referring to now, he was overjoyed because a brand new warship had been built. It was called the Mary Rose. It was a trim vessel. I have the picture of it there, which you can see afterwards. It was a trim vessel with guns pointing out from the ports the side of the vessel, which was unusual. It was a new innovation. There were 100 knights or so on board with their retainers. And she was ready for review. And so the king hastened down to Portsmouth, and proud Henry took up his position on the fortifications overlooking the sea. Yes, the Mary Rose was ready, and she came on. The word had gone round that the king was on the battlements, and sure enough, there he was, old as he was too, and all the men on board began to crowd towards the side of the vessel to hail the king. Perhaps some of them wanted the king to see them. They were close enough. It was a brave moment. The crew was cheering, and the crowded court on Portsmouth's ramparts responded. And then suddenly the ship appeared to falter. And before the horrified king and his court, the Mary Rose, pride of the English fleet, its newest vessel, capsized. There was heavy loss of life, and the ship took most of its crew to the bottom. There was no reason ever discovered for this disaster. And a few years ago, if you will remember, in Portsmouth, they began to bring the wreck of the Mary Rose to the surface. They got it ashore 450 years after she had been wrecked. Many of us, interested in history, of course, were fascinated by the story. I decided that I would try and solve the question of what caused it to sink. And so I had, on this occasion, gone into a deep reverie, what I call esolepsy in my books. I began in this withdrawn state to hear men cheering at a great distance. And the cheering seemed to come from across a sheet of water. And in amongst the cheering, there was the sound of a ship's bell. Then suddenly the cheering and the shouting began to change. Suddenly there was alarm and fear and screams which took over. And all the time the ship's bell rang out its incessant note. Things misted over in my reverie, and I was back in my own life 45 years ago. I was a soldier returning to South Africa towards the end of the war. The ship that I was on was De Nieuwe Amsterdam, a 45 to 50,000 ton vessel, a big one. We were coming into Durban Harbor, and I remember it so well, and the wharf was crowded with relatives and friends and well-wishers, coming to welcome 14,000 men on one boat home. We on board didn't know which side the ship was going to dock. We wanted to spot our friends, as you would expect, and to wave to them from the ship. Suddenly, the ship began to back in to the quay, and 14,000 men anticipating the other side to be the place they would get the best view of their relatives, rushed to the side that was now going to be presented to the quay. So many men were there that the ship suddenly listed very heavily to one side, 45,000 tons. Bells rang out, and we were told to spread our weight evenly over the decks of the ship, 14 decks. The vision of the memory of the actual event merged for me into the actual event as it had occurred, and I came out of it. I now knew why the Mary Rose had sunk. The rush of men heavily laden with armor, some of them carrying 200 or 300 pounds weight of armor, and the crew, their rush to the gunwale, the side of the ship, to see the king, had tipped the warship to one side. Perhaps it caught the steersman unawares, and he pulled the tiller the wrong direction. Perhaps the guns broke loose. They hadn't been tried and tested in severe conditions and were not firmly moored and slid to the side as the ship listed. It had a tremendous effect on the nation, this disaster, and of course Henry was inconsolable. And the memory of it would carry over a long time. Certainly, Shakespeare, Richardson, that's how I describe them, certainly Shakespeare Richardson, in his play The Tempest, drew a lot of material from that disaster. In the play, the grief-stricken Ferdinand hears Ariel, a divine creature, I repeat that again, a divine creature, trying to comfort him for the loss of his father in the shipwreck. And so the lovely song came across the waters. Full fathom five thy father lies, of his bones are coral made, why those are pearls that were his eyes. Nothing of him that doth fade, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. Sea nymphs hourly ring his knell. Ding dong. Hark, now I hear them. Ding, dong, bell. And so, this gives some clues to the way in which the seer can feel his way forward. One thing is very important, that there must be atmos. There must be atmos, and maybe just the public interest in this event, which was headed by Prince Charles, a descendant of Henry VIII, perhaps all this generated the required atmosphere for that sort of seership to occur. Getting back nearer to home, I was rung up by a friend, a very respected middle-aged friend. I was rung up by him the other day, and he asked me some sought for advice. He was traveling back home in a car being driven in the front seat, and suddenly he said the atmosphere changed, and he became overwhelmed with immense grief. And that grief continued until he was in tears and broken down almost. And the nub of it, the visual element of it, was Iraq. But the war was over. Iraq. And it struck him tremendously, and that's why he rang me. And I believe, and he is somewhat of a seer, I believe that that experience was warning him of the terrible matters that are occurring now on the borders of Iraq. And so I always say, never believe that you can't be a seer. If you gather together the conditions for it, the dedication, the one-pointedness, and the sincerity, avoiding mere curiosity, I'm sure you would find that you could do exactly the same. Release this latent power from you. Grief, joy, love, wisdom are easily released by triggers from the unconscious. The grief of the families of the Mary Rose was not lost. It gathers itself, and we know from psychic experiences that grief is one of the most powerful accumulators of energy. And this energy lies in the unconscious, and when a situation involving grief arises somewhere, there's a passage of energy through to that region. But that is also true of joy and love, wisdom. And they can be released by triggers from the unconscious. Most of us find meditation appallingly difficult. And of course, we all like to have some rewards. In the future, literature and music will be produced that will play upon the human mind like a piano on a keyboard. And the themes of the music, the lyric, the melody, these will trigger a release of energy from the inner worlds and a receptiveness from the person listening. Grief evoked like the words of Full Fathom Five, thy father lie. Joy, courage. How is this for arousing the unrelenting power of the first ray, the ray of will and power? Listen to this piece of poetry, which will be preserved forever in the future, because it will be recognized that it triggers the release of energy that makes a person objective. The Assyrian came down like the wolf on the fold, and his cohorts were gleaming in purple and gold, and the sheen of their spears was like stars in the sea, when the blue wave rolls nightly on deep Galilee. Like the leaves of the forest when summer is green, That host with their banners at sunset was seen. Like the leaves of the forest when autumn hath blown, that host on the morrow laid withered and strown. I'm sure many of you, not because of my reciting it, but because of the lovely words, have felt things go down your spine. Now, you can do that. You can incorporate such things to give you courage when you are faced by challenges to whatever it is in your personality that is being challenged. And I will refer to this again, but certainly it is used in the future, because in the future, anything which this age and earlier ages has endowed to mankind will be regarded as priceless. Anything of beauty. Now, what can the future tell us about the human body? It can show us that man does not live by bread alone. Man is also sustained by a vital energy, which we know from the Hindu is called prana. When we eat an apple or a pear or any food for that matter, two types of energy are extracted from the food. First, of course, is the energy derived from nutrition. Our digestive organs break down the food we eat and change it into glucose and fats and proteins that we can burn in our body cells. And we know all about this ad nauseum. From this food, we sustain our bodily organs. They've got to have it. The food is made of gas and liquid and solid particles, and we metabolize it. When we burn this food in our cells, we obtain energy which we can measure in calories. All very mundane. But according to the perennial wisdom, the wisdom of the ages, the sayings of the wisest and most spiritual of mankind, there is another kind of energy, the energy of the life force, the energy of vitality. And when this energy is in motion, we call it just that, vital force. It is quite different to metabolic energy, the metabolic energy of food. You can take a pair of twins, identical in structure. You can take a pair of twins, perfectly healthy, both fed in the same way. But the one may present bristling with energy, lively, objective, cooperative, and the other twin, for some unknown reason, may be listless, neurasthenic, uncooperative, dull. Reports coming home from school all the time that he doesn't try, and so on. Why? If we follow psychology and medicine of our day, they would say that there is nothing physically wrong. Oh, but there is. The one boy or girl has access to vital force, to the energy of prana. They both have access to food. The other has plenty of metabolic energy, but is still lifeless. Why? We are living in a world that demands more and more from many of us. We call this stress, the stress of living. In terms of nutrition, we have just about scraped out every source of energy that exists in terms of the foods. Whether you eat proteins only, or whether you reject fat, or whether you eat white sugar or brown sugar, we've tried everything. There's nothing left. Vitamins, diets, jogging, relaxing, it doesn't promise much more than enough to keep us going. But the stress is increasing. We are quite a new venture in humanity's existence. And when people are placed on the frontier of anything, they must expect to get battered around a bit. And we're on the frontier of a new age, the age of Aquarius. Or if you like, the last 20 years of the millennium. Sorry, the last 20 years of the bimillennium. Of course, things are difficult. The real breakthrough, though, in terms of human energization is going to be through the discovery, officially. We've known about it for thousands of years. The discovery of prana. Where does it come from? It comes from dark matter. And I'm going to tell you something about dark matter later on. For 30 years, I've called it subtle matter. Matter that cannot ordinarily be seen, but under extraordinary conditions, both in what is being viewed and in the viewer, can be, to some extent, interpreted and seen. Prana comes from the center of the sun. It comes from the center of the sun. At the center of the sun is dark matter. There are layers of extraordinary physical matter within the sun, behind its disk, but right at the center there is dark matter of an extraordinary nature, about which science knows nothing. All you can get is science saying, well, we don't know why, but the temperature at the center of the sun must be 36 million or billion degrees. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if I pick up a handful of mud, I have in my hand three states of matter, which we would all agree on. I have sand interpenetrated, or if you like, solid, interpenetrated by water. And I have water interpenetrated by air, oxygen, if you don't mind. And the three together give me a handful of mud. Now that is not difficult to understand. Let us then see where prana fits in to this. Because of course, man's physical body, his physical frame, is known to us. Good heavens, 7 years at medical school taught me that. We know all about it. Can't explain everything, but we do know about it. And so we talk about a man as being a person who knows that he has a physical body, but he doesn't know all about the energy of that person. The physical body is made of solid, liquid, and gas, and they all interpenetrate each other beautifully. But according to the wisdom of the ages, this physical body is interpenetrated by a different state of matter. A different state of matter. If I now start to particularize, we would say that the wisdom says there are seven states of matter. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Solid, there it is, solid body. Liquid, there it is. Liquids in the blood, the body, 85% water. And that water is extraordinary too. And then, of course, the gases of the body. There it is, the physical body, the seventh densest plane, the sixth and the fifth. But what of the rest? According to the perennial wisdom, there is a great medium of etheric energy, energy of and material from these four planes, the higher four, five, four, three, to one. And that material, with its energies flowing through it dynamically, floods the earth. And we have a word for it. We say that the earth is interpenetrated by an envelope of etheric material, and in ancient literature it was called the anima mundi of the earth. It was called the anima mundi of the earth. And what have we here? Within the scope of the four top planes, we have ions. If you've been to chemistry at school, you know what I'm talking about. And we have other states of matter, subatomic particles. Here we have neutrinos, which can't even be measured today without going into a deep mine and having a tank of water the size of this room, and you're lucky if you catch two of them. The reason for it being that they are neutral. And the main body of the etheric structure of man, the infrastructure of man, is neutrinos. Neutrinos. They live together. They are the other 80% of material that science is struggling to find. They form part of the etheric body, contribute to its aura. And then finally at the top, we have the Anu, the ultimate physical particle. More about that later. And all these together constitute a body of vitality, a body of vitality. And if you are indeed healthy, and if the climate is right, this vitality can be emitted from the surface of the body in good health. It's as simple as that. It is physical material, but it is not seen ordinarily. It is semi-radiatory, whereas dark matter is not radiatory in terms of what we call the electromagnetic spectrum. Now, we know that this body picks up energy from the sun, and energy flows into it. We'll talk about how later. And this energy is what is known as prana. And the body just loves it. Let us then see how the body likes it. The body has organs, stomach, it has the heart, the kidney. These are always recognizable, so I choose those three. How do they get the prana? And what does the prana do? I must put in, of course, the brain. Remember the twins, the brain of man and his nervous system. And they get prana. Well, they get the prana, we may as well put it in, prana, 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 prana. They get the energy of prana through a system of circulation in the body. And the storehouse of prana, which is pumped in to the various organs, is known as a chakra. And so in man we have a series of chakras. And if we're talking about the stomach and the duodenum, we know that these are particularly energized by a chakra, which can be described in terms of lotuses. In fact, the chakra's energy is prana, and it is rotating in good health. And as it rotates, it spins energy out in little processes which we call nadis. And these nadis infiltrate physical tissue, nerves, skin, everything, and release prana into these organs. And if that prana is impeded in any way, ulceration of the stomach, peptic ulcer, if it is impeded in any way, then you will get warning of illness very much in advance of when it actually occurs, which is the reason why complementary medicine is catching on. Because there are alternative sources of energy. And if those alternative sources of energy are impeded, then there will be trouble. And some clairvoyants can look at them. Not all of them. Some can look and say, oh, your solar plexus chakra is faltering. You're having emotional stress. The solar plexus will pass, chakra will pass this on to the solar plexus nerves, sympathetic, parasympathetic, and these nerves will tend to take part in the disease process. And so what I'm talking about is not pie in the sky. It's for you to take note of. And there is another chakra called the heart chakra. And the heart chakra, as you would expect, feeds energy to the heart muscle and its other processes. And all these chakras are in fact located on the spine. If that's the spine, there's a stalk and a funnel near the surface of the body with a lead to the chakra. There's the heart chakra. And that can move slightly. And then there is, of course, others. And so on the spine, you have a series of chakras. And they are stores of vitality. If you're in good health, they can store vitality. You can't do that with food. You can convert it into fat, but it's not instantaneously available. But with prana, if the amount of prana in a chakra is only unit one, you can multiply unit one a million times. It will take vast amounts of prana and hold it, retain it, circulate it, pass it out through the aura, cleanse this way. And so there are laws governing the infrastructure, the etheric infrastructure of our bodies, which, if they are observed carefully, are the basic foundation for complementary medicine. There are two huge nadis on the spine. There's the spinal cord. There are the chakras. All right. There are the chakras, five of them in any usual normal person. Only five functioning at a time in average humanity. And if you have got a solar plexus chakra that is grabbing all the prana because you are so damned emotional, something else will be deprived. Only five can function at once. And so on the spine, there are the largest three nadis of all. The largest three nadis of all. There is one called Ida, and it twists its way around the spine. There is another called Pingala, which is complementary to the first. And then, finally, there is the central nadi, which reaches up to the brain and is the wand about which Mercury's caduceus winds. So these are the foundations of the etheric body. And from these centers, as I say, there are these funnel-shaped vehicles which lie on the skin and suck in prana. And so we now have to consider how the forces of prana, the energies of prana, which come ultimately from the sun, get into the body. Because if we knew how to do that, we could not only help ourselves, but we could treat our patients. Prana arrives on the earth in great quantities from the sun, and if the earth is unclouded in a region, that region's sunlight will be laden with prana, laden with it. So much prana exists sometimes that it has to gather, it has to materialize in some way. And the prana gathers seven of these ultimate particles of etheric matter. We call them the anus, the ultimate physical particles in man. It gathers the seven of them. They are linked together in different ways. Seventh one there. And in this manner, the prana can be stored. The prana can be stored in this structure. And we can see it sometimes. We can see it in the atmosphere as vitality globules. Tiny little scintillating points of light, so fine and so short-lived, you're not always sure that you've actually seen them. But anyone can see them. Sitting in an aeroplane, perhaps being vibrated, say your astral body is slightly out of alignment with you, and putting your eyes out of focus, you can see these things by the billion in the atmosphere. Now, these vitality globules have a strange characteristic. When C.W. Leadbeater looked at the oxygen atom, he found that the oxygen atom was a spiral, a helix, a spiral. And he found that attached to the oxygen atom were these incredible objects called vitality globules. And there could be hundreds on an oxygen atom. Or there could be very few indeed, according to the sunlit conditions and according to the integrity of the etheric physical body of the person concerned. So now we have a very important entree into the physiology of the etheric body. And the entree for prana is that when we breathe the prana in, the vitality globules, as one enlarged, the vitality globules are stripped off the oxygen molecule. I've said molecule, but we'll say atom. And these vitality globules break down, and the energy of prana, which is holding them together, holding the little particles together, leaves and passes into the nadis, to the great Ida Sushumna and Pingala, and in turn these send the energy to the chakras and to the nervous system. And so the answer to our postulate of these twins is that the one has access to prana and the other has not. And there might be a very simple reason for it. And so many conditions which absolutely confound medicine, like influenza and so on, many of these conditions have a very simple background to them in terms of energy absorption in the etheric body of man. There is another way. Prana gathers in the food that we eat. If the food that we eat is fruit and fresh vegetables, in vitality globules, these vitality globules are linked together and they form a grape-like structure and are stored in the spaces between the mesophyll cells of the leaves of plants or fruit or whatever. And so when we eat fresh food, prana's in everything, but in different degrees. I stressed a little while ago that the prana of a chakra can be unit one or unit a million according to how you are running your body. And similarly, food is like that. And the luscious, natural foods have got immense amounts of prana. And this prana is contained in the food. When we eat it, it is released, and again, it goes to the system that I have described here. Lastly, there is a direct entry of prana into the body. And the direct entry of prana into the body is via these funnel-like structures. In practice, they are not numerous. There are smaller ones, which I haven't mentioned. And the best place for prana to enter is usually in the neck below the ear, in the back between the shoulder blades, and over the spleen. There's your spleen, clench your fist and